From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we explore the legality around vaccine liability and how it could apply to a future COVID-19 vaccine. Then we learn how grief can turn into prolonged grief disorder and how the pandemic could be causing an uptick.
In this time during this COVID pandemic, it also could be due to the excessive isolation and loneliness, as well as survivor guilt.
Plus, travel guide Rick Steves shares new things he's learned to appreciate while staying at home in the summer for the first time in 30 years.
I am learning how to cook. Believe it or not, I had never made pasta. I had never felt a knife cutting through a crispy onion until this last couple of months. And it's a joyful thing.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin is currently facing a massive spike in coronavirus cases. The state continues to break daily records of confirmed cases. Our death toll reached more than 1,600 people this week, and hospitalizations have more than tripled in the last month. In the meantime, there are a number of COVID-19 vaccine trials taking place around the world, including here in Wisconsin, as scientists work tirelessly to develop a vaccine to help fight the spread of the disease. As this vaccine is getting fast-tracked, questions about liability if something goes wrong have come into focus. The Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program is run by an agency under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's been designated to handle any issues with a COVID-19 vaccine. But some say this program isn't adequate for this vaccine. Instead, patient advocates say compensation for vaccine injury should go through the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, also known as Vaccine Court. Each program has different sources of funding, and both are relatively unknown and underutilized by the public. To help break down the many questions surrounding vaccine liability, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Milwaukee attorney John Groth.
So to start, you know, the question that's at the top of my mind, and I'm sure many listeners amid the development for a COVID-19 vaccine, is there such a thing as liability in a vaccination when you agree to be part of a trial?
That's a fantastic question. So let's say yes is the answer. And I'm saying that with some hesitation because I'm a lawyer and that's what we do, is it depends. So in a vaccine trial, what you're doing is you're volunteering, right, to go and take part of a vaccine trial. You know, and there are a number of them at UW as we speak, as we sit here. What the federal government recommends, they don't require, but what they recommend is that in the documents that you fill out when you're taking part or when you're getting ready to take part of the trial, that those documents say what you can get if you're injured, okay? And some of these will talk about that you'll get medical care, for example, if you're injured because of the vaccine trial. Others will say that you'll get anything limited to what's in the obvious risks or the, I guess I'll call it a schedule for what might happen as a result of the vaccine trial. So they'll limit it further. Other than that, probably not much. You can't get much from being in a vaccine trial. The limit is to what you're contracting with the vaccine trial, you know, if it's UW or whomever, what you sign and what you contract for.
So when it comes to vaccine liability for vaccines that are approved and distributed widely, where do drug companies stand?
Oh boy, do you have hours to talk about this? So let's go back to the 1980s, okay? So in the 1980s, there was a law that was passed because they wanted to experiment, I guess is what I'll say. And let me go back even further, you know, take this to Wisconsin, Fighting Bob La Follette. Hopefully your listeners know who Fighting Bob was, a very progressive person. Back in his day, back in the early 1900s, Wisconsin was on the forefront of a no-fault system for workers' compensation. And there was a grand compromise that, you know, before this, people didn't have any compensation. If you're injured on the job, well, you get fired. Sorry, you can't do your job. You're fired. So they changed that, and for good reason, obviously. And so people, when they're on the job, they don't have to show whose fault it was. They simply have to show they were on the job and they were injured. And then there's a schedule. There are booklets that we have in the office here that we give the people that say, okay, this is what, in essence, what the pinky finger is worth. This is what your shoulder is worth. This is what your back is, you know, those kind of things. It's based on a schedule. That's very similar to the compromise, the experiment that took place in the 1980s with vaccine law. So with vaccine law, they said, we're going to try a no-fault system. And let me go on another tangent here. I apologize, but it's important nowadays when you're talking about, you know, Trump and Biden and the election, because there's been some talk of tort reform. And during every election, it seems that people talk about tort reform and what the president's going to do with appointing judges for activist judges and tort reform and things like that. Well, this was an experiment in tort reform in the 1980s, and it worked. I think it works. I think many people will agree that it works.
So what is tort reform for listeners who may not know?
So tort reform is trying to protect and have the balance between going to court for really any reason. You know, for example, the easiest explanation is suing a doctor for anything. So that's tort reform, is that you try to protect certain parts of society, protect doctors, protect manufacturers so we can keep jobs, so we can keep doctors, things like that. So it makes it harder to find your day in court. So for vaccines, what they said was you can try to have a system where you're suing vaccine manufacturers every single time over every single vaccine, but that's going to be extremely expensive for these for these vaccine manufacturers, extremely expensive for the victims, and it's going to have a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of unknowns. So they said, let's do this, where we're going to have a program set up that's going to be funded by a tax on, or a fee paid by the vaccine manufacturers for every vaccine that's administered. So I believe it's 75 cents per vaccine, and that money goes into this fund. And if you can show that you have an injury on this schedule, and I have a schedule right here, if you can show that you have an injury that's on this schedule within a certain period of time related to this vaccine, that's all you have to show, you'll get compensation. There's billions upon billions of dollars that's in this fund. So it's been building over time, and they haven't paid out, because there have not been that many claims historically. There's in the thousands potentially per year, as opposed to other kind of claims for medical malpractice or for car accidents and those kind of injury claims. So there are fewer claims occurring. And I think in part because people don't know about this very unique system. This is such a unique federal National Vaccine Injury Compensation System that they're just not used to it. So people don't know, number one, if they go to a lawyer, the lawyer doesn't know about it. And number two, if you go online, it's not the easiest thing to figure out how to do.
So basically, the U.S. system shifts liability for vaccines to the government, shielding drug makers, because basically they ruled that widespread inoculation against disease is considered a benefit to society. And you mentioned the 1980s, and that's when the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act requires that vaccines be both, quote, safe and effective. So you mentioned it's only in the thousands that these claims are filed. I don't believe that there's any claims made against the COVID trials right now because it's a little too new. But statistically, it's pretty rare if you get injured via vaccine. But if this does happen, what options does someone initially have? How do you file a claim? You mentioned it's these unique government agencies that many people don't know about. So to break it down for listeners, we have the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, which is run by the Department of Health and Human Services. And this has been designed to handle any issues with a COVID-19 vaccine.
Correct. And they have a lot of protection. The Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program and the Public Readiness Emergency Preparedness Act, I guess those are things that came about just, I guess, somewhat recently, in that they're trying to figure out how to protect people since really 9/11, right? And having emergency measures in place and saying there's a national emergency. With SARS or the swine flu or things like that. It goes back to those days. there's a big difference between the countermeasures injury compensation program and the vaccine injury compensation program. Because the countermeasures is obviously, as you can imagine, it's more stringent because it's riskier because there's an emergency. So you have to do things faster, which obviously at COVID, there's a rocket docket here trying to get things going. Obviously, everybody is looking at, well, if they're doing it so fast, maybe they're not being as thorough as they should. So the countermeasure to that is the Public Readiness Emergency Preparedness Act that says that if you're injured, really, there's a lot more immunity for drug manufacturers. So when you're talking about COVID-19 and those kind of vaccinations and the trials, if you're looking for compensation from anything related to the PREP Act and the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, it's going to be pretty darn difficult. And just let me tell you this, too, with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, for like the flu vaccine, for example, you're going to get the help of an attorney to guide you through the system. With the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, because that does not pay for experts, for costs, for getting medical records, it doesn't pay for an attorney, you're going to have a hard time because you're going to have to pay out of your own pocket. The ability to get into the courtroom doors on this is affected simply because of the way the system's set up.
Right, and with the CICP, is a major factor of the difficulty in, you know, quote, having a successful suit with them, you know, you have to prove that a drug maker acted with willful misconduct. And, you know, is that nearly impossible in many cases?
I think nearly impossible is pretty accurate. And if you mean a 0.001% chance, I think that's pretty darn close. I mean, you look at any kind of litigation that we're involved in on a national scale, you know, like for like Zantac, for example, showing that there was something in the drug itself that was a carcinogen, that simply by putting it into your body, you're gonna introduce a carcinogen into your body. That's very rare. I believe that drug manufacturers are doing whatever they can, knowing that they can only get held liable for willful misconduct and such, that they're going to have good lawyers to instruct them that they'll do things in a manner that's going to protect them ultimately. I can tell you, this is all scary stuff. I don't want to get COVID. I don't want anybody to get COVID. And I want to have some normalcy, right? I want to get back to normal. What's that going to mean? I know that there are some big insurance companies in the area who said we won't go back to normal and have people back in the office until there's a vaccine.
Right. So that brings up one of my other questions is when the vaccine does become widely available and approved, you know, it's in trial stages right now throughout the world. There's thousands of trials going on right now. Can either the government or perhaps, as you mentioned, your insurance company or your employer, can they force people to get vaccinated or impose restrictions on your activities if you haven't been vaccinated? You know, you gave the example of like, you need to be vaccinated before everyone can return to the office. Say that's one stance that is going to possibly occur down the road. Is this a future concern? And is there legal stance to this? Is that possible?
Well, you have to keep lawyers busy somehow, right? And this is one of those ways. So I say it's similar to when you get into your car and you have to have a license and your license has certain requirements on it. You know, maybe a doctor knows that you can only drive in the daylight, for example, and then you have a limitation on your license to only drive in the daylight. You know, things like that. So the government is able to require you to abide by certain standards. And if you don't want to abide by those standards, then you don't do that activity. So you have to find something else to do. You know, you don't have to drive a car. I think there's some similarity there. If you're epileptic and you have seizures on a regular basis and you don't take your medicine, the DMV can take away your license, or they can prevent you from even having a license in the first place. That is, I think, a similar situation where employers will be able to say, you don't have to work for us. You know, I think it's going to have some gray area where in Wisconsin, there's two exemptions you can claim for having vaccines, a religious exemption and a philosophical exemption. Now, there was a representative, I think Heinz is how you pronounce his name, up in Oshkosh. He said earlier this year that he was introducing a bill to remove the philosophical exemption from vaccines. So the only exemption would be a religious exemption. So I think this is something that we're going to talk about a lot over these next few months. What exemptions are people going to have when an employer says, you either get this vaccine or you can't come back to work? You know, going back to just the basic tenets of employment law in Wisconsin, we're an at-will state. So an employer can fire you for any reason, just as long as it's not a bad reason, you know, for religion, sexual orientation, you know, things like that, ethnicity. You know, so they could also fire you and then not rehire you, or fire you and say, I'm only going to rehire you if you get a vaccine. And I think that would be allowed. Now, don't quote me on that one, because I think the law is so gray. And I think we're going to have so many fights over this that my friends who are employment lawyers are going to probably have many sleepless nights in the next few months to years. But it's a very interesting thing to talk about.
Right. And, you know, this is coming to light. And as you mentioned, we'll continue to perhaps get more attention as the pandemic continues. And with programs like the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program and the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, you know, they differ so much. Do you think these programs ultimately help or harm people based on their, quote, success rate?
Well, with the, boy, that's a fantastic question. I wish I was a philosophy major. I think the plan is and the goal is to help people. And I think in general, vaccines help people. And I think that's to the point where we have laws in place that kids have to get vaccinated to go to school. So I think it's a helpful thing. I think it's very interesting that with all the talk now about getting vaccinated, the number of flu vaccines that are out there to be administered are, I think the last numbers were 90 million or something along those lines. So there's a lot. And now you have everybody getting into the vaccination system. So I think in general, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is a good thing. It's underutilized. I think doctors don't know that there are injuries related to vaccine administration. So I think that's good. I think the countermeasures program is necessary because we're in a global pandemic and it's scary stuff. So I think it's important that we have vaccines to help everyone. And I think it's something that should be tweaked, that should be changed, so we can get more compensation into people who are legitimately injured because of these very risky vaccines that are getting pushed through the system.
Well, John Groth, thanks so much for joining us to help us break down this topic a little bit.
Thank you.
John Groth is an attorney here in Milwaukee with Groth Law Firm. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up, we'll learn about prolonged grief disorder and how to recognize it in yourself and loved ones. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic can't be overstated. More than 8 million Americans have been diagnosed with the infectious disease. Unemployment has skyrocketed, and the economy is struggling to hang on. People are isolated in their homes while others are dying in hospitals, unable to see friends and family. In these dire conditions, it's no wonder that experts say we are also facing a mental health crisis. Some psychiatrists, like Dr. Joseph Govius, fear this environment could cause an uptick in prolonged grief disorder, and the impact could be felt long after the pandemic subsides. Dr. Govius is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joins me now to talk about this disorder. Dr. Govius, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
I'm glad to be here.
So,
To start here with a kind of a basic thing, how do you describe prolonged grief disorder?
So before we describe prolonged grief disorder, Joy, I think it's important to understand what acute grief is. So grief is a natural response to bereavement, which is the experience of loss of a loved one. So typically, acute grief is something that individuals who have lost a loved one experience. It's a natural process. It's an intensely painful and disruptive and often overwhelming emotional response. Fortunately, most people adapt very well to the death of a loved one. Grief is an everlasting response. But most people adapt. They also adapt to the accompanying changes in their life circumstances. They understand the change. They integrate this grief into their ongoing lives and, in fact, productive lives. They understand their life circumstances have changed, but they resume to live. They find the sense of purpose and meaning and possibilities for happiness. This process of adaptation takes time, but it happens. However, about 7 to 10% of individuals who experience a death of a loved one goes on to develop this condition called as prolonged grief disorder.
So how does grief go from being something that is acute to this prolonged grief disorder?
As one acutely grieves, there are certain thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that occur naturally during that acute grief process. Most of these times, these thoughts and feelings could help and encourage the natural grieving process and accelerate our abilities to reach the stage of integrated grief. However, there are certain thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that could impede and derail this adaptive process. Dr. Scheer from the Center for Complicated Grief at Columbia University calls it derailers. Derailers is an acronym. These are common impediments to adaptation. These could include one doubting that they did not do enough for the person who died. It could also be due to anger and bitterness that one cannot resolve or let go of, or some form of an insistent belief that the death that occurred was unfair or wrong and shouldn't have happened, excessive avoidance of the reminders of the loss, or rejecting support from others and unable to let others help, feeling hurt and alone. And more importantly, in this time during this COVID pandemic, it also could be due to the excessive isolation and loneliness, as well as survivor guilt. These type of impediments are considered derailers and could increase the risk of prolonged grief disorder. Also, older age individuals who have past history of mental health conditions such as depression and morbid anxiety could also be at higher risk for prolonged grief disorders.
Yeah. You mentioned, of course, the pandemic and how it's impacting how susceptible people might be to prolonged grief disorder. You mentioned, of course, that there's a lot of loneliness that people are feeling as a result of being stuck in their homes, but there are also other things that you cite. What is it about this moment we're living in that puts people at such a great risk for developing this disorder?
So we are all very aware of what's happening in our community and around the world. So many of these deaths are often sudden and unexpected. At the same time, deaths from non-COVID-related causes are also happening during this time. There are several restrictions that are currently in place because of the pandemic, regardless of the reason for the death, be it COVID-19 related or non-COVID-19 related deaths. So for instance, our healthcare systems have implemented stringent limits on visiting ill patients in the hospital settings. In fact, that is also extended to assisted living and long-term retirement communities, including skilled nursing. So the permission to visit in person, if granted, is for a very brief period of time. So in individuals who are unfortunately dying during this pandemic, it's most of the time it is the healthcare professionals, a bereavement coordinator, a chaplain, or support staff, and not family members who are in the sides or in person there in the sides of the dying persons. Many a times these healthcare personnels are wearing personal protective equipments, and so there are some limitations in the ability to connect with the patients as well. So the death itself, as we know, or the circumstances around the death, as we know currently, looks very different than what it looked pre-COVID. There are also other changes that has happened in relationship to the grieving process itself. So for instance, there are several physical distancing policies that are in place that significantly affects the cultural and religious rituals that provide the grieving individual a supportive social context. Funeral arrangements and services are sharply curtailed during this pandemic. Also, faith and cultural-based practices are not really permitted. Private viewing even when it is allowed, is often only for immediate family members. And so there is a sense of increased isolation and loneliness in this time of great need. Travel restrictions, there are some that are still there, especially if one would decide to travel out of state or even out of the country. So there are several obstacles that are in place during these practices. This is also happening at a time when there are other secondary losses that our community is experiencing. We have a lot of individuals are struggling with unemployment-related worries or real losses, financial insecurity, and even the fear of being contaminated by this virus is there in our community. So there are so many different added issues that each individual is struggling with that makes the grieving process even more complex.
So we know this is a problem. We know that people right now are incredibly vulnerable to this kind of grief. What are the ways of preventing it, or if preventing it isn't really an option, which I think for many people right now it probably isn't, what should people do if they believe they or a loved one is already dealing with prolonged grief?
So that's a very important question, Joy. First of all, it is the increased awareness brought out by all of us, including this particular segment that you're doing, Joy, and thank you for doing it. Understanding and promoting awareness, not only of the healing milestones that would accelerate the process of integrated grief, but also understanding the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, what we call as derailers, that can stall or halt the grieving process. So that is the first and foremost thing to do in this time. The second major aspect of it is understanding what prolonged grief disorder is. Prolonged grief disorder, as I said before, grief is normal. It's a natural process as part of bereavement or a loss of a loved one. Prolonged grief disorder is something that is a clinical condition, is a pathological clinical condition that is present in about 7 to 10% of individuals who are grieving. This has a specific criteria in place that needs to be met before one could be diagnosed. And it has to be diagnosed by a health professional. So here in prolonged grief disorder, one needs to experience persistent and pervasive and intense yearning or longing for the deceased person, with or without preoccupation with the thoughts or memories of the deceased person. It not only is important to have this, but these symptoms need to be present in a clinically significant degree that occurs nearly every day for at least 6 to 12 months following the loss of a loved one. So it has to be after that specific period of the time that one could diagnose prolonged grief disorder. You don't diagnose prolonged grief disorder during that acute grieving process. So once you make the diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder, or even if one is experiencing intense and pervasive symptoms during the acute grief period, one needs to understand that this could increase the risk of prolonged grief disorder, especially if it is in light of the presence of derailers. If that occurs, the family members who may see this before their loved one who is intensely grieving sees it should closely monitor, especially the vulnerable groups, and seek help and reach out for help.
I think when we're talking about help, we're talking about going to a therapist or a psychologist, someone who deals with these kinds of issues. Is that right?
So sometimes this is, as I said, it is seen by family members. And yet other times it might be the primary care physician or another health professional or even a family member who is well educated about these risk factors and this pathological condition who may find it. And once you understand it, yes, it could be reaching out to a therapist or a psychologist or a mental health professional who is well versed in diagnosing and treating this condition. In the meantime, family members could also do certain things that could be helpful, and the individual who is grieving could also do certain things to help themselves as well.
What kind of things would you do to help yourself in general if you do find yourself dealing with these feelings?
One of the major symptoms that individuals start experiencing, in addition to what I mentioned in terms of prolonged grief disorder, is also disruptions in our eating habits, sleeping habits, and our exercising and physical activities. Taking care of ourselves kind of falls off. And this is something that is better sometimes noticed by family members. So that would be something if we notice it as a grieving individual, then we could pay more closer attention to it. One of the other areas could be that in this day and age where people are doing a lot of texting and spending a lot of time on social media, it might be important to keep in mind that doing just that may not be sufficient. Maybe reaching out more in terms of in person, or letting others know through social media or other virtual means, like through a video visit, for instance, could be helpful for the grieving individuals. Simply asking for help to individuals who one is close to may be very beneficial during this period as well. It may also be the case that for people who are supporting an individual who is grieving, one could make them be aware that you are available for them if they need to, without even getting into their space and making that worrisome to them or making them feel overwhelmed by one reaching out too much. Taking a social distance walk with a friend, sitting at a safe distance with someone in their yard, asking friends and family via social media to share stories about the person who they lost, putting up memories together in a book, and being able to create a slideshow of your favorite photos of a person you're grieving. These are all ways that one could help themselves grieve and others could help a grieving individual.
Well, Dr. Govius, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you very much for having me, Joy, and thank you for doing this.
Dr. Joseph Govius is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine in the Institute for Health and Equity at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Coming up next, PBS host and tour guide Rick Steves talks about the impact the coronavirus has had on travelers and the industry. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The coronavirus pandemic has restricted travel in the U.S. and around the world. The cancellation or postponement of trips has had a massive impact on the travel industry and leaves the future of travel itself uncertain. So what do you do if you make your living cruising around the world? Rick Steves is a PBS travel host, guidebook author, and owner of a tour company that typically sends thousands of people to Europe each year. But with Americans restricted from going to Europe, he's spending a lot of time at home. Rick Steves joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share how he's been coping at home and what he sees on the other side of this pandemic.
Well, the current state of travel, if you're international travel, is zip, zero, nothing. And I'm not struggling with that. I think, patience is not an American forte, but we've got to develop a little patience, because if ever haste makes waste, you know, people are saying, oh, we got to get our economy up and running. If we're hasty, we're going to be the last people back on board. And Europe has dealt with a very difficult period, and they are making huge strides. And now, incrementally, travel is opening up in Europe. And, the terrible scenario is one that I feared a long time ago, that Europe would be past the epidemic and Europe would be opening up to travel, but our country would be the laggard, the one that was unable to get their act together and get a grip on this thing. And that's where we are now. Europeans are traveling around Europe and Americans are not welcome. And we're not welcome because they don't like us. They'd love us to come there, but they have discipline, they have patience, and they want to be healthy more than they want our money. And until we get healthy, we're not gonna be able to be welcome in Europe. So I applaud them for that discipline. And I'm encouraging my fellow countrymen to be patient, embrace science, and recognize that this is going to be a while, but it's not going to go forever, and we'll come out of it, and that'll be okay.
Traveling impacts many economies, and with everything shut down or extremely slim, what do you think is the status of the travel industry, particularly hubs, airports, hotels, tourism, the like?
Travel affects my economy, that's for sure. I've got a payroll of 100 people. And we've got zero revenue because our business is bus tours in Europe. And with my publishing, I've got 50 guidebooks in the bookstores. You know, the destination guidebooks are not selling. I was talking to my publisher, and what is selling is road trip guidebooks for domestic travel. And travel will open up, and it'll open up incrementally. First, it'll be, you know, people road tripping to around their state. It'll be the French people going to the French Riviera. It'll be the Romans going to the hill towns of Tuscany. It'll be the Swiss people hiking in their Alps. Then it'll be individuals who are bold and determined who are traveling. And then after that, when it gets really stable, then we'll be able to put the organized travel back together. And that's how a lot of people travel, you know, on bus tours or on cruise ships or whatever. But people wonder, they ask me what it's going to be like after this. Is it going to be forever changed? And nobody knows, but I'm pretty confident that it's going to get back to normal, essentially. I mean, we'll all be a little more tuned into hygiene and, you know, and these kind of things. But my idea of travel, you know, the Rick Steves style of Europe through the back door travel, is the opposite of social distancing. It's, you know, you go to Paris to get kissed on the cheek, and you go to Italy to do the passeggiata and to gather in the piazza with everybody, and you go to Ireland to drink beer with strangers. Let's see, what do they say? Strangers are just friends who've yet to meet. That day's going to come. And a lot of people in the tourist industry, it's a, you know, it's tough, but they're gearing up for this interim period of how do we travel and still not be able to connect. And people are eating dinner in bubbles in Amsterdam so they don't have to get any germs. I'm not going to go to Amsterdam if I have to eat dinner in a bubble. You know, I'm going to wait another 6 months and then go and really travel. So I think patience is it. And then what I've been doing, Audrey, is focusing my wanderlust and my traveler's spirit on staying at home.
Yeah. Are you finding pleasure in being at home?
Huge pleasure. This is my first summer in Seattle in 30 years. And I've heard it's nice, and it is quite nice. You know, I'd love to be in Europe right now. I've spent 100 days in Europe every year since I was a kid, but it's not in the cards, and we got to play the cards we're dealt. So I'm sort of really addicted to being productive, you know, and just it happens like this, you know, all day long for me, and I love it. I've got 100 people that I work with, and we can turn on a dime. This is sort of a therapy for somebody who's addicted to productivity. And I'm walking dogs. For the first time in my life, I'm actually cuddling with dogs at night and walking them as the sun goes down. I am learning how to cook. Believe it or not, I had never made pasta. I had never felt a knife cutting through a crispy onion until this last couple of months. And it's a joyful thing. People have all along asked me, you know, anything you would have done different in your life so far? And I always thought, no. But right now I go, yeah, I wish I would have gotten enthusiastic about cooking earlier. So, you know, that's kind of a blessing. I think it's a chance to dust off old passions. You know, I play the piano more now, and I oiled up my trumpet. And, you know, it was a time to get to know our community and to focus at home and enjoy this little breath. Take a moment, you know, don't be so fast. Don't be so industrious. Just live in the moment. And that's not a bad thing. I think it's a temporary thing. The big question will be, how much of these little insights, how many of these corona bonuses will we embrace once we get back to normal? Because I think there potentially is some long-term benefits that can come out of this pause. There's certainly more to life than increasing its speed. And if we can think about that now, and then remember that when we come out of this crisis, I think we'll be better off for it.
Do you think you've been able to, on the flip side, take your optimism and your lessons you've learned traveling and connecting with people and apply those lessons to being at home?
As a matter of fact, yes. I can be more focused on community. It's clear to me we need each other. It's clear to me we need good governance. It's clear to me rugged individualism is not a good way to handle this thing. You know, we need to work together. We need to recognize community. We're going to come out of this a humbler nation. We're not going to be as powerful and rich as we like to think we are. I've been thinking a lot about this, Audrey, and I think in the future, the existential challenges, the big threats to us are not going to be conventional, that you fight with military hardware and walls. We will fight and protect ourselves by working with other nations, by embracing science, by recognizing that the big challenges of the future are going to be challenges that are blind to borders and that are not going to be addressed with military hardware. And we need to recognize that and work with the family of nations, compare notes, and to recognize that win-lose is not going to work. What's going to work in the future is win-win. We're in this together. And if there's chaos and desperation south of the border, that's not a stable world. And if we want to be safe, we've got to recognize that. That's why right now, as you know, our governors, our legislators are trying to put together another Corona aid package. They're probably come up with $1 trillion. Out of that, people who care about world hunger are advocating for $12 billion. That's 1% of a trillion, basically, 12 out of 1,000 billion. $12 billion will be dedicated to people who are desperately poor in the developing world, the 10% of humanity that's trying to live on $2 a day. And I was just in Ethiopia and Guatemala making a show for public television about hunger and hope. It's airing all over the country now. And boy, I learned that even if you're motivated only by greed, you don't want to be filthy rich in a desperately poor world, because it's not a nice place to raise your kids. And you can address this problem because you love your neighbor. But the reality is, when, you know, in the privacy of the voting booth, half of America does not love its neighbor. Half of America votes for its own personal security and financial well-being. And you can take care of desperation south of the border out of selfish reasons too, that you really want to have a more stable world, because a more stable world is a safer world for us and our neighbors and loved ones and children. And I think that's going to come out of this next aid package, is that sensibility. But when a traveler is homebound like I am and not using his or her passport like they're used to, my passport's going, what's going on? You're supposed to be putting me in your money belt and going somewhere exciting. We have to take that moment and capitalize on it and learn from it and embrace it. Every night when the sun goes down, I stand on my balcony overlooking my town. I'm looking out at the Puget Sound and the Olympic Mountains, and I play taps on my trumpet. And I did that mostly because my valves don't work. It's been 30 years since I played the trumpet, so I have to stick to the harmonic overtone series like a bugle. But I play taps as the sun goes down. And when I'm done, there's a smattering of whoops and hollers and claps all over my community. And it's just a little 1 minute reminder at the end of the day, as the sun's going down, how blessed we are and how we're all in this together. And if we don't work together, we're not going to get out of this struggle. I just love that moment. And I think that's part of taking a traveler's approach to things and employing it right here at home.
And I suppose that's the way that long-term Europe and America will be changing post-pandemic, is if we all take that traveler's mindset.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of boils down, do you have a mindset of bridges or a mindset of walls? And I'm a big fan of bridges. The world is filled with loving, joyful people and families just like us. It's filled with good people. And if your worldview is shaped by commercial television news and talk radio, you have a different worldview, but it's not based on personal experience. It's based on fears that somebody else is trying to jam into you so they can sell more ads. And, how do I know that? Well, I've spent 4 months a year living overseas, hanging out with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And I'm thankful for that. It challenges my norms and it humbles me. And it wallops my ethnocentricity. And that's a good thing. It's kind of simple when you think about it in terms of tourism and travel. But, my very favorite chapters in my new book, For the Love of Europe, are chapters that feature people. It's people that makes the travel great. And when you can travel all over the world and you can have a selfie stick and do your Instagram shots and learn nothing and come home not changed. Or you can put that selfie stick away and you can just get out there and meet people and get out of your comfort zone. That's why I say, our mission here at Rick Steves Europe is to equip and inspire Americans to venture beyond Orlando. There's two kinds of travel, and part of it is escapism, and that's, theme parks in America, which is just fine. But there's another kind of travel, which is getting to know the world. And that, For the Love of Europe is just a collection of 100 essays that celebrate that approach to travel. I'm so thankful to have had the opportunity to put these essays together. And it's the perfect book for this quarantine time, this lockdown time, because people who love to travel, people who wish they were traveling, they can grab this book. And you've got 100 bite-sized essays in 400 pages to take you all over the very best of Europe.
It is kind of a good taste of both worlds that we can have for us right now. And in the future, down the road, what's the place you're most looking forward to returning to and reconnecting with?
Well, the big heartbreak for me was this summer, I was, along with my normal research and TV production that I was going to do for my TV series, the big event was going to be a Best of Europe bus tour. It's our flagship tour. It's the Best of Europe in 3 weeks and 3,000 miles, doing all the greatest hits from Amsterdam, down the Rhine, over the Alps, Venice, Florence, Rome, the Italian Riviera, the Swiss Alps, and Paris. We booked the whole bus just for my extended family, which included my daughter and her fiance and his family. And I wanted to get to know my daughter's in-laws because she's getting married. And it would be great. And none of them had ever been to Europe. And it was going to be, and my son was going to be the tour guide. And he's a great tour guide. And for the first time, I was going to go over and just enjoy the tour with
right,
all of these.
Relax.
and relax and let my son do the work. And we had to cancel that. It's not canceled. It's just put off until we can travel again. But when Europe opens up, we're going to do that trip. And that's going to be the trip of a lifetime for me to be getting to know my extended family with all the places I love in Europe on a Rick Steves Best of Europe in 3 weeks tour. So I'm looking forward to that. And then I'm also looking forward to going to Europe and just picking up the rubble after this storm and putting it back together again to make sure all of our guidebooks are up to date and accurate. so Americans can rely on us to enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar in their beautiful next vacation to Europe.
Your catchphrase is typically keep on traveling, but what would be your new current catchphrase for this time until we can keep on traveling?
Oh, that is funny. I like to say, happy travels, even if you're just staying home for a while.
There we go.
Keep on traveling, even because you can travel with that traveler spirit right here at home. And we need to be patient and we need to stay positive. We need to work together. We need to embrace science. And we need to know that our norms will come back. But, 2020 is the 1940 of our lifetimes. And we've lived our lives without any a big disruption like that. And right now we're in the middle of that. And it's going to take a little while. But if we stick together, if we take care of each other, we're not suffering. I mean, I'm privileged and you're privileged. And there's a lot of people that are in much more frightening kind of situations right here in our own country. And if we can be mindful of that and take care of each other and work together to get through this, we'll come through it and we'll learn from it and things will be okay.
Rick Steves is a PBS host, travel expert, and author. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and his latest book is called For the Love of Europe. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.